Welcome to the School Sucks Project,
a podcast, YouTube channel, and an online community
dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives,
home education,
critical thinking,
peaceful parenting,
organization and productivity,
and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes,
infographics, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast.
And get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
What I've seen is a systematic attempt at just really eliminating people's ability to think altogether. So it then becomes, if you get rid of the ability to think, the desire to think, the desire to be curious, right? Because now you've told these kids that that's what equates to learning and learning sucks. Mm-hmm. What you end up with is this populace that is then just like, okay, then you know what? Just tell me what to think. Tell me what to believe. Tell me when to believe it. And then whoever has the loudest voice for them wins, right? And those loud voices come through social media, or they come through their parents and you know, wherever it is. But we eliminate critical thinking because it's just who's the loudest voice in my life. And that's what we have gotten into. And it's not just saying this from a look what we see the division wise right now. I'm in the political arena. I've worked with over 300 companies these last 6 years outside of education, because I'm helping them transition and lead and manage the younger generation. The biggest thing I get is this exact thing where they're saying kids come out and they just know how to play school. How do I get my A here at this job? What is the rubric? I'm not going to understand. I'm not going to take initiative on how to do anything. I'm not going to think for myself. I'm not going to try to provide value. You know, we have, I think, systematically dumbed down society, and school is a big part of that.
This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is Thursday, October 15th, and this podcast is an introduction to the life and the work of someone I think you should know about. His name is Matt Beaudreau, and the highlights, we're going to get into a lot of this stuff in our conversation today, but Matt is the founder and president of the Acton Academy in Placer County, California. He is the host of one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called The Essential 11. We'll explain that in our conversation today. And he's a very sought-after keynote speaker on topics in education, entrepreneurship, and beyond. Matt's also done a lot of work as an educational consultant and a corporate trainer. So not only does he have a very good sense of the current problems plaguing the schooling system at all levels, he also does not hold anything back, and I think that's one of the reasons why he's been so successful in these pursuits. And even though he's become a man of great influence in this arena, as well as a successful entrepreneur, and the founder of an alternative school focused on self-directed learning, Matt was, at one point, deep in the belly of the beast. He worked as a public school teacher and a public school administrator. And today we're going to begin talking about some of the events that helped him to awaken, to get clarity on the schooling problem, and of course, to start speaking out. The title of today's episode, The Departure, is quite clever, and frankly, you should expect nothing less from us here at School Sucks. But the reason why I named the show that is, of course, The Departure is the first act in the hero's journey. So like I already mentioned, a huge part of this is talking about Matt's departure from the school system. But also right now, in the backdrop of 2020, we talk about how many parents and students are more ready and willing than ever to leave the ordinary world, the world that has been left unquestioned for so long. And when it comes to, you know, the 2020-2021 public school year, it's become almost impossible not to question this. So we'll talk with some optimism about that. But the reason why I'm referencing the hero's journey is the original plan for this show was to outline a hero's journey for teens. The mission of the Acton Academy, which has over 100 locations globally, and this I'm reading from their website, is to inspire each child and parent who enters our doors to find a calling that will change the world. And goes on to say, our promises to your child, he or she will begin a hero's journey, learn to be a curious, independent, lifelong learner, develop a deep respect for economic, political, and religious freedoms, cherish the arts, the wonders of the physical world, and the mysteries of life on earth, and discover his or her most precious gifts and learn to use them to solve difficult problems. So through our conversation, we'll expand on all of those things. But what I really wanted the focus of the show to be was this hero's journey for teens. Matt and I got so wrapped up in getting to know each other, we only got through like two of the items on my outline, and that was just great as far as I'm concerned. So he'll be back in the near future, and we will do a further exploration of the hero's journey as it applies to young learners. So yeah, Brett, you're saying that is a really clever title. But wait, there's more. Matt also references one of my favorite films of all time, the 2006 Martin Scorsese epic, The Departed. How is that going to fit into this conversation? You'll find out soon. But if you wish to learn more about Matt and his work, his website is mattbodreau.com, spelled exactly as it is in the title, actonacademy.org. Or if you want to go to Matt's specific school, it is actonplacer.com. That is Acton, actonplacer.com. And using his name spelled correctly, you can find him on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. I'll make sure all of that info is in the show notes for today's episode. Final thing before we get started, please remember that School Sucks is a listener-supported show. If you're enjoying the work that we're doing on integral theory, or if you want access to any of our bonus series, including In Pursuit of Utopia, our ongoing, long-form, delightfully tangent-filled conversation and exploration about failed, I would say failed, attempts to build ideal societies on a variety of scales. You ever live through anything like that? Where like a small group of strangers who are really kind of disconnected from everybody else in the populace in some really important ways try to merge them all together into their vision of the perfect society? Whoa, it can get pretty wild. Danny McCarthy and I have been working on that project for over a year now. We have added, I would say permanently added, Kevin Cole to our conversations. We're currently working on one about the British Empire. So the answer to that question I just asked you is yes. Also, Emotional Manipulators for Hire, my new bonus series with Nathan Frazier, that is off to a great start, I would say. We recently put out our second episode about tribalism. And occasionally, if I really think there's something the supporting listeners of this show need to hear, I will also put in an University weekly discussion group. Those are usually about an hour long. They include an array of interesting voices. Most recent one was with Scott Hambrick. And that reminds me, Scott's project, Online Great Books, is one of our partners here at School Sucks. They currently have enrollment open. There is a link for that in the show notes if you want to get a discount. You just enter through our portal, you help yourself, you help them, you help us. Who doesn't win in that situation? So if you're interested in reading the great books of a Western civilization in a way that offers community and accountability, please check out Online Great Books through our portal. And I'm sure many of you are listening to the Online Great Books podcast, so you've been able to get a feel for what Scott and Carl and the rest of the team do, and I think it is totally awesome. I'll tell you this, though, they're real exclusive over there. They only open enrollment like a few times a year for about a 1 week period, I think. So enrollment is currently open, but it closes Sunday the 18th, this Sunday the 18th. And if you miss that window, you have to wait probably a few months before you can get in again. But Brett, I need new friends now. I understand. So the time to act is here. But if you're just interested in keeping School Sucks going and growing and accessing a lot of great content beyond what's in the podcast feed, you can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks, or to see other support options, schoolsucksproject.com/AV. And I greatly appreciate everyone who helps us out that way. But that's it. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Matt. Remember to visit the show notes, huh? Start following Matt. And I would say, definitely start listening to the Essential 11 podcast. All right. We will be back next week. Thank you for listening. Here we go. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, my friend. I'm glad we got to make this work.
Yeah, it's long overdue. I mean, you were recommended to me by our mutual friend Joel Bine, who I would just let pick all my guests for me. So I'm glad you're finally here. Unfortunately, I made a mistake in my show prep, which was listening to one of your most recent podcast episodes right before we started with Dennis Prager,
Okay. Right? Yeah. So yeah.
Everybody, Matt's podcast that I highly recommend, and he's got a ton of overlap with past School Sucks guests, as well as like some heavy hitter type names. Like I would put Dennis Prager in that category.
Yeah.
So the podcast is called The Essential 11. We're going to open talking about that. But man, you know, I was just listening to it. I've heard like four or five episodes, and I was just listening to the Prager one to continue to get a feel for, you know, your conversational style, and it really put me in a state. And now now I'm in this state.
Well, because hopefully it's a good state.
It's a state of agitation, but that's cool. And I like Dennis Prager, and I agree with almost everything that he was saying in that show. And I would say that our greatest alliance, maybe the three of us, is around probably free speech and higher ed, right?
Yes,
so.
Sir.
You were involved as, I guess, like a co-producer of No Safe Spaces, the documentary they made.
Correct. Yep, correct.
I was actually part of a podcast when that came out that gave money to No Safe Spaces as well. We've got the t-shirt, gotcha. The college t-shirt with the pacifier on it. I'm sure you have
one. Yeah. Yep.
So in the mix of everything that's going on right now, I was like, this will be nice. This will be nice to escape, to get back on a focused conversation about education.
That's
but
so
now... It's hard to escape, isn't it? It's hard to escape the world of politics and current events and all that.
Unfortunately, it is, man. You know, in what you said right there was politics, right? It's hard to escape politics. The reality is not everything's a partisan issue.
Right. Yeah.
It isn't, you know, I mean, and it really shouldn't be, but everything is being made to be that. And, you know, and I've had the, you know, interesting experience because of things I've said, because of things I've done, because of starting the schools I've started, because of my friendships with, you know, people like Dennis and Jordan Peterson and some of these guys, but then also with my friendships, professional athletes that are in the mixed martial arts world, or because I will have people who will go, oh, okay, yeah, I know who you are. You're super liberal, super left wing. And then I'll have other people go, man, you are super right wing. You're this super conservative dude. Mm-hmm. Right. Everybody wants to label based on that. I'm like, actually, I don't really even get involved in politics. I think if I took a look at everything and if I had to pick a party, I'm more probably on the libertarian side. I think people should be able to do what they want, say what they want, as long as they're not harming other people. And that's kind of where I am. But I don't get involved in politics. I like people. Mm-hmm. I really do. And I can make friends with infants to in-laws to inmates to I can be, you know, yeah. I can be friends with anybody because I genuinely like people. I genuinely want what's best for them. And to me, it's just plain silly to think that, you know, we're in this arena where we can't have civil discourse anymore. That's just, it's crazy to me. You know, there's nobody on the planet that you fully agree with 100% of the time.
Right.
Period.
Yeah.
And that's anybody listening. That's their case too. My wife and I, she's my best friend in the world. There are things we disagree on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, so it's a crazy world where we can't get back to that.
So on my show, we talk a lot about what I think real education is supposed to be, or at least what elements of real education are. And that includes things like critical thinking, includes psychology, mm-hmm. includes media and information literacy. And we are really trying to pursue an understanding of this problem that we're talking about, where it's like you say something and you have to be labeled, right? It's two buckets you can be in, Matt, and those buckets keep getting like bigger and bigger, but also move further and further apart.
Sure.
And, you know, so this tribalism, this division, you know, on my show, we're pursuing it from a media angle, a social psychology angle, a more even conspiratorial, like outside subversion. These conspiracy theories were actually mainstreamed and very popular over the last four or so years, but they go back much further than Donald Trump. And, you know, from a tech angle. Obviously, you know, the way big tech works today as far as engagement and keeping people online is very much based on tribalism and division and exacerbating those tribes and those divisions.
Sure.
So I'm wondering if you, as you look at that landscape, because this is actually going to be a transition into a lot of what we talk about today,
yeah.
you have like a schooling or absence of true education explanation for the phenomenon that we've seen really get so much worse over the last 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think the schooling agenda, and I like that you use the word schooling because I always differentiate that when people talk about, well, we need education reform. I'm like, no, we need schools to go away. It's not education, right? Education is the natural state of a human being that's paying attention, and it's a natural state of curiosity, right? We're always being educated. We're always looking to be educated. We're always trying to educate somebody else. And that's the natural state of human being. So schooling is what we're talking about. When you're talking about schooling, you're talking about a system. And you know, what I've seen is a systematic attempt at just really eliminating people's ability to think altogether. So it's then becomes, if you get rid of the ability to think, the desire to think, the desire to be curious, right? Because now you've told these kids that that's what equates to learning, and learning sucks. Mm-hmm. What you end up with is this populace that is then just like, okay, then you know what? Just tell me what to think. Tell me what to believe. Tell me when to believe it. And then whoever has the loudest voice for them wins, right? And those loud voices come through social media, or they come through their parents, and they come through, you know, wherever it is. But we eliminate critical thinking because it's just, who's the loudest voice in my life? And that's what we have gotten into. And it's not just from a, you know, I'm not just saying this from a look what we see the division wise right now. I'm in the political arena. I've worked with over 300 companies these last 6 years outside of education. And the biggest thing that I get, because I'm helping them transition and lead and manage the younger generation, the biggest thing I get is this exact thing where they're saying kids come out and they just know how to play school. They're just like, give me, how do I get my A? How do I get my A here at this job? What is the rubric? I'm not going to understand. I'm not going to take initiative on how to do anything. I'm not going to think for myself. I'm not going to try to provide value. You know, we have, I think, systematically dumbed down society. And I think school is a big part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like 10 years ago in the very, very early episodes of my show, I said, and this is experience as a student, this is experience as an educator, this is an experience as a tutor and a college consultant, that yep. Schools seem to have three hidden lessons embedded. It probably has more. Like, I know Gatto had his seven lesson school teacher.
Yep.
But the three big ones were obedience, conformity, and apathy, right? And it, yep. being taught, even though most of the lessons are implicit, they're consistent. And being taught obedience is basically a way of surrendering and outsourcing decision making. Being taught conformity is really outsourcing and surrendering identity. And when you remove all of that personal responsibility, you know, that third lesson, apathy, is sort of just like the natural
byproduct.
Yeah, it's the byproduct. Yep. But it extends to philosophy. It extends to obviously all of the things that we're talking about here. And there has been no change in that in the, you know, 10 years before I said it or the 10 years after I said it. And I think now a lot of people who are promoting self-directed learning or alternative education, or I guess you could all just call that education,
real
an alternative
education
to school.
Yeah, exactly.
We're having a moment in that a lot of people are going to feel school in a way that they haven't before. Parents, yeah. I think, have done a good job. And I totally understand, totally sympathetic to it. And there's not a lot of judgment in me saying that parents have just kind of pushed that responsibility off on the schools because everybody else is telling themselves a story,
sure.
You know? So, yep. So why can't I? And that story, now that school has come home in a yep. way that, you know, I didn't want the two things to blend like in the way that they have over the last 6 months, but this is the way it's happened. But now that school has invaded the home, I think parents are going to have, and already are starting to have, a lot more questions about what this is what's going on there, what they're paying for, yep. what they've been apologizing for, even for years.
Yep. You're right, man. This is a very, this is kind of an emperor has no clothes moment, you know. And I'm like you, right? I'm sympathetic to. I understand the parents' position. I am also the most pro teacher. I'm very, very pro administrator. I'm pro all those things.
Yeah.
I am very much anti the system that they are working in, right? It's not a personal attack on them. And I get that all the time. Like, you hate teachers. I love teachers. I was a teacher. My friends are still I love teachers. That's great. The system, though, is a hot flipping mess, and they can't overcome that. They will to some degree, you know, if they're good humans and have good DNA and connect with other people, that's great. But you're still completely, you're completely hindered, you know? And so I think parents are starting to get a taste of that too. They're seeing what's going on, right? And you know, all the virtual school, as things have come home online, parents are going, okay, well, like, you know, the teachers aren't prepared for this. And so that's why this is going on. So one, yeah, there's an element of truth to that. Teachers aren't prepared to go virtual. I fully agree. But also what the parents are seeing is just kind of some highlights around what is already happening. Things were already a mess.
Yeah.
Like the kids aren't just apathetic because they're on a Zoom call. The kids are apathetic.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Like, you're just highlighting what is already going on, whether we had gone virtual or not. So you're getting a taste of that right now.
Has anyone come, this is a question that I like to ask people who are in my world. Has anyone come to you and asked you for advice, knowing what you do, knowing the experience that you have that we're going to talk about soon, or your role in the Acton Academy, right? Have people who are currently stuck in that world come and said, Matt, do you know anything? Is there any way you can offer me some advice here?
So within the first general week or so, within the majority of the country going virtual, right? This earlier in 2020, I had no less, this is a conservative number, I had no less than 50 phone calls from teachers, administrators, superintendents from all over the country that I've worked with in some capacity, right? That were calling me saying, what do we do? What are you guys doing? What do we do? And when they were asking me, what do we do? I'd start to flesh out the majority of the time what they were really wanting to know is, well, now what is the system we put in place to try to salvage what's going on, right? Like that is what they were looking for. They said, are you guys struggling as you go virtually? My answer was no, and which is a honest answer. And they said, why? What are the systems you have in place? Help me with the systems. I said, well, you need to go back a whole lot further than just the systems, right? So I can give you a little bit of something systemically, but that's not going to be your issue. Your issue is that you have never really fully allowed a child to understand how to be self-directed. You do not give your students the tools to design their own life, to truly actually know what it means to be self-directed and earn, you know, have the personal responsibility on how to move their hero's journey forward, right? And so I was talking to one superintendent in particular and on the phone, and he's like, I don't think that's great. I think we do a good job of giving them, you know, personal agency, and really we just need to get some iPads, you know, delivered to the homes of people that need them, and then we're going to be okay. And I said, okay. So I was pulling into my garage as I was talking to him on my in the car, and I said, okay, buddy. I said, you know what, Mike, let me give you an example. I said, go ahead and hang up right now. I said, I want you to call me back, but I want you to FaceTime me. I'm not going to stage anything. I just want you to FaceTime me. I'm going to show you what I'm talking about. He says, okay. So I stayed in my garage. He hangs up. He calls me back on FaceTime. And I said, don't say a word. I'm going to flip my screen around. I'm going to walk into my house and, you know, my kids go to my school. We're just going to walk in and let's see what they're doing. All right. So I flip the screen around. I walk in really quiet. And as I kind of start to sneak in and I come around into my kitchen, my oldest daughter is sitting there at the kitchen and she's nine. Mm-hmm. She's got her computer up and she's going, no, you guys. Okay. Let's think about this. So sunk costs and variable costs, right? And she's having this conversation around sunk and variable costs. And we listened to the conversation play out, and it was, in, you know, going from this business perspective of having it, they were, you know, kind of plotting out the next moves in this business that they were designing. And, you know, so I let them kind of finish the conversation. I came around and said, Morgan, I said, I'm so sorry to interrupt. I said, but can I show my friend Mike here who you're talking to? And she's like, oh, sure. And you go on the screen and there's another 9-year-old and another 8-year-old, and there's no adult on that screen.
Yeah.
And I said, this is normal for us. You have 3 9-year-olds talking about a high level concept in depth, not going off course. And they are, you know, engaging like an adult would, and there's no adult there to make sure it happens. So this is the difference in what I'm talking about. This is what we're helping to produce, and they're enjoying every single minute of it. They are driving this. This is the difference. This is why we didn't struggle going virtually. So yeah, we had a lot of people come into for advice.
What was his response?
He honestly got a little irritated, and that was almost the end of the conversation, which was fine. You know, I understand. I think it's at a very emotional time. He was struggling as a leader, but he almost kind of poo-pooed it and then kind of came back to me in a very short, and this is somebody I talked to relatively regularly. But I think what that did was kind of put a perspective in there that it shook him a little bit. And so I'm still kind of getting a little bit of the shoulder, you know, or cold shoulder, which is interesting. I often will take the brunt from teachers, from administrators, whatever. I will be personally like, I don't like him because I will expose something. You know, I often say there's a lot of people that really like me because I always tell the truth, right? And equally, there's a lot of people that really don't like me because I always tell the truth.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of those cases.
I think there has to be some sense of powerlessness in that position, right? And
totally
seeing
is.
That it's like, okay, so Matt, I'm in a train headed east at 100 miles an hour. What's the fastest way I can get to the Pacific Ocean?
Yeah.
I got bad news, conductor.
Yep. Yeah.
You got to go the other way.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. I would think that would be really difficult. And I know we both worked in and around public education, right? Or even institutionalized schooling in different forms that are very different from the Acton Academy where you
very
are
different.
Now. But do you find that you live in California, I live in New Hampshire.
Yes, sir.
Politically, again, back to politics, these are two dramatically different states, probably two of the most different states in the country.
Agreed.
Do you find that the amount of regulation, and I know in California, there's literally helicopters, at least in Southern California, there's literally
true
helicopters
story.
Flying around over people. But that kind of helicoptering around over a population, all of the increased laws, regulations, rules, taxes, that they have a degrading effect on culture. And I've noticed this in the difference between, because New Hampshire is the live free or die state, very close to Massachusetts, which is the opposite. Not far from New York, Connecticut, we're surrounded by these kinds of states. And I find that the actual like social interactions, quality of life, culture actually degrades by having that amount of control over people. And I think that, you know, if you take this out of like state to state, state as laboratory politics, and you look at how people are schooled and the amount of control and supervision and just these implicit, again, but constant messages, you are not independent, you're not trustworthy, do not trust other people, you need our authority. I'm guessing your 9-year-old never was exposed to a public school, if this is
That's exactly right.
that age.
On purpose. You're 100% correct that that is the effect that it has on the human state, right?
Yeah.
And so state to state, yes, it does look vastly different. And I can say that from the perspective of spending a good amount of time in all 50 states. I've been everywhere. So I've seen all of that. And I can tell you there is a vast difference in the human population as you go state to state. There just is. But school and schooling and the system of schooling does exactly what you are talking about, is a degrading thing. And you don't even necessarily realize it. You know, I tell my kids, I've talked about it with a few of my guests, you are always being brainwashed, you know, is the term that I like to use. And the thing is, the question is, okay, well then who then are you allowing to do the brainwashing? Yeah. Are you allowing yourself to do the brainwashing? Are you allowing good influences? Are you allowing bad influences? Are you allowed, right? Like that's, as you grow as a human, you are taking in all of these other stimuli, and some of this are people's opinions and thoughts and things you're reading and things you're watching, right? But who is feeding into that? That was the intentionality behind the fact that my kids were never going to step foot in a public school. Yeah. I was going to make sure that they spent their days Monday through Friday, if we're going to do the school thing, it is going to be an environment, you know, I think is conducive to them having freedom and getting to actually learn who they are and who they want to be, whatever that looks like. You know, there's a great line from the beginning of The Departed that I've got on my phone. Literally as a screensaver on my phone, and Jack Nicholson's character at the opening of the movie says, I never wanted to be a product of my environment. I want my environment to be a product of me.
Yeah.
And I very much want that for my kids, you know, and obviously for other kids as well. But you know, I always tell my parents, I love all of your kids. I love my kids more. And so this school is built for them. The integrity of that will always stay true because they're here.
All right. So quote from a fictional gangster actually makes a great transition, believe it or not, into talking about the Essential 11.
Of course.
And here's how, right? That idea of I don't want to be a product of my environment. I want to kind of start or have the Essential 11 near the beginning of this conversation, because it probably is the best way for strangers on the internet to get to know you, right?
Yep.
You're in their ear. It's a podcast. This is a great way to build relationships. They're kind of one way, but still.
Sure. Yep.
So the Essential 11 is a reference to a series of questions, and you actually built this off a Tim Ferriss idea, like kind of the approach that he took, and it was tools
Tribe
to
of Mentors.
Oh, Tribe of Mentors, all right, where he kind of formulated a list of the questions he most wanted to put to his dream guest. Can you talk about how you've modified that for your podcast?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So we ended up doing a focus group of 1,500 youth. So when I say youth, they were ages, the youngest was 13, the oldest was 22.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking majority high school and college age students from around the country. And really the question was very simple. It was just, hey, give me three questions that you would ask high-level operators. And we defined high-level operators as somebody who is just making an impact, and could be in any industry, right? And so, you know, politicians, sports, whatever that looks like, what were the three questions you would want to ask those people if you were got to sit down and ask their advice? You got to sit down and have coffee, you know, what would that look like? And so, you know, with that, we ended up with 4,500, closer to actually 5,000, you know, questions, and just kind of cultivated that top list of, you know, as close as we could to those, that top list of what are the most common questions that we got. And so that was kind of the, that's the methodology. And so then it was about going to these individuals and using those questions as the framework for the conversation, you know. And, you know, I'm not there to, not that there's anything wrong with anybody ever doing this. I don't bring guests on where I'm like, I'm going to go ahead and just argue against all points that you make. I want to get their honest feedback to these questions. Right. And I'm hoping that they give me different answers than the other guests have. And it's been wildly different through 75 different guests, but I do only reach out to people that I'm connected with and people that I actually like and respect. I mean, that is part of it. And so there tends to go in these swings, and just like in speaking, right? When I would speak for, you know, maybe a military organization, naturally that would beget me getting other military related gigs right after that, because they're like, ooh, we just had this guy, you got to book him. And then somebody else like, oh, okay, we'll bring you in, right? So you end up kind of going on these swings, which then people like to look at and define. So we just had Dennis on, right? And so from Dennis, I got, and again, teaming with them on the No Safe Spaces, and I already knew some of these guys, but so Dennis, you know, I think we have Dave Rubin is coming out, Charlie Kirk is coming out. We got a lot of these other guys that are associated with PragerU, Tito Ortiz, and some of these other guys that, so that's when people are looking and go, okay, Matt's super right wing, super whatever. And it's like, sure, I just got connected, good guys, good conversations. And so, yeah, they have great advice for the young people, man. It's fun.
So in the very first episode of the show, the introduction, you talk about being a kid, loving Michael Jordan. At some point, like most of us do, we realize we're not going to be Michael Jordan, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So you talk about going through this process of pattern recognition. And I wanted to hear you talk a little bit about that, because this is actually what relates to the Jack Nicholson quote, right? You recognize the pattern of somebody who basically creates the patterns, I should say, somebody who creates a world around them, who might have started out as a, you know, a smaller and less powerful guy responding to his environment, but very much creates. By the way, have you seen The Last Dance? Are you watching The Last Dance?
Oh, I watched it. Yes, sir. Okay. Yeah, absolutely did. Yeah, absolutely did. Couldn't help it. A lot of nostalgia there for me.
Oh, indeed. And you see how like that is very much like a Michael Jordan centric world by the end of it. And like looking at his beginnings in North Carolina, the whole thing is not about Michael Jordan. And I think it does a really good job. It's a Netflix document. It's on Netflix, right? It's a documentary.
Yes, sir.
Like the end of the Bulls dynasty, the end of the Phil Jackson era. And it's really, really well done. And, you know, you see like the humble beginnings of this man, but then this Michael Jordan centric world that is created by the end of the 1990s. So this idea of pattern recognition, and once you realize you're not going to the NBA, what are you trying to do with Michael Jordan's story, Michael Jordan's actions, Michael Jordan's practices as a younger man?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a number of people in my repertoire that I look at. You know, I know I mentioned Michael Jordan on a couple of the episodes, but one of the best concepts, there's a book called Think and Grow Rich, right? By Napoleon Hill. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm not a money driven individual. I never have been, but, I like the book. One of the, really the biggest thing that I took away from that book when I read it was his concept of developing kind of a mastermind or a board of directors, so to speak. Mm. Right. And so for all areas of his life, he talked about, you know, if this was a business decision, he would have this board of directors that he would consult, and he would consult those people oftentimes, not even in person, right? They would be somebody that he had read their, biography, or it would be somebody that he saw somewhere else, somebody that he had met and spoke to, somebody that he was following, whatever. And he would consult them, meaning he would think about, okay, well, you know, what would Michael Jordan do in this instance? If he was a relevant person to go to, what would he do? How would he attack this? What would he, you know, how would he look at this? And so I've got this kind of mastermind of people that I've met, people that I haven't met, people that I've read about, people that I've seen on TV, people that are alive, people that are movie characters, people that are book characters. I mean, some of the people in my mastermind literally aren't even real people. But there is something about that person, and I don't ever want to live an inauthentic life. There is something about that person that I go, okay, I have an element of that in me, but they've done it better. why? What did they do? And how do they think about this thing? So I try to make decisions a lot of times or take action based on what would this person that I admire do? How would they potentially do that until their actions, until their thoughts become my own actions and my own thoughts? You know, and so Michael Jordan for me still epitomizes somebody that, not even necessarily in a good way, but was so obsessed with his mission that he was going to bring up everybody around him to meet that mission, to meet that goal. And I think you see that in that documentary, whether they liked him or not.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That was irrelevant.
Right.
And I'm not saying I want to go that far and like, I don't care. And that's not it. But what I admire about him was his just stone cold obsession with obtaining the goals and his, a mental trap up there of that guy could get himself ready for battle at all times to accomplish what it is he wanted to accomplish. You know, as an entrepreneur, there are times when you are just like, this is awful, this sucks, this is lonely, this is hard, this is whatever that is, you know, and he is one of those guys that I look to who he didn't complain. He just, let's go battle, let's go fix it. And so for him, you know, for me, that's a piece that I kind of look to him, and I've got many people in many different arenas that I look to in that same kind of fashion and try to recognize those patterns.
So he demonstrates a set of principles, Michael Jordan and others, right? Demonstrate principles in a game that we can't play, right? Whether it's, you know, maybe really high levels of fame or athletic achievement or whatever it is, you know, being in the Fortune 500, they're probably just not fields that we are going to be on, statistically speaking, right?
Right.
So how can we extract those principles and use them in our own customized game, right? Back to having an environment that is around us, like TK Coleman. You've had TK on your show, right?
I have, man. TK is a great dude.
I love TK. When he was on my show, he said something like, I'm playing a game that is so finite and so customized to me, I'm going to win because nobody else even wants to play it, right?
I think that's
such a great idea of, you know, another challenge of entrepreneurism is that social comparison, right? Mm-hmm. I look at other people who are doing similar things to me. Like, I'm a podcaster. Yeah. This guy's a podcaster. I'm a former educator. Jeez, so is Brett Weinstein. Why is he doing so much better than him? It's an easy thing to do, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that niching down and playing, like, it, not denying parts of yourself.
Sure.
If there are things that you really like and enjoy just to make strangers happy. I think that was a huge mistake that I made early on in this process, was just trying to talk to too many people.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's an easy thing to get wrapped up into, right? Is trying to make other people. My game, and when I say the game, like, I think there's a game quality to everything. There's a game quality to life. There's a game quality to relationships. There's a game-like quality to, you know, to business. There's a game, like, all of that is in here for me. It is very, very quiet in here, because one of the things that I have worked very hard to cultivate is a ridiculous self-awareness. What is going to make me excited? What is not? How am I feeling today based on what I ate, how I slept? Did I get a workout? Did I not? How am I feeling? And if I'm not feeling ideal for the task at hand, then what is it that I need to do to best prepare myself? Do I need a cup of coffee? Do I need to watch a video real quick? Do I need to call my wife? Do I need to talk to one of my kids and just get a hug? Do I need to? It's this obsessive level of self-awareness, which is also a brutally honest place to live, because I know my faults, and there are many. I tell people I'm good at like three things, probably. Mm-hmm. And so I stay there. But if there's things that I'm bad at that I want to get better at, then, you know, I'm brutally honest with that. But it's this continuous game of introspection. And that is the only game I'm playing. It is irrelevant of what somebody else thinks of me, whether they love me, whether they hate me. And that's a great place to be. And that was something too that had to be cultivated. I looked at people that I really saw a self-confidence, and I don't mean an ego. Everybody's got ego. I don't mean ego. I mean self-confidence, where I think when you're ultimately at that place of self-confidence, you are at peace.
Yeah.
Right. There's a mental peace in here where you really do not get too high because somebody's like, you're the best, you're the best, you're the best. And you don't get low because somebody goes, you suck, you suck, you suck. It's just, no, I'm living with integrity to what I feel like my purpose is. I can look myself in the mirror and there's a confidence there. You know, and I worked on cultivating that as well. And that was another thing, pattern recognition. Like, how do these people get to the point where they truly don't take other people's opinion of them to heart, where it affects them emotionally and practically, you know, and practically?
Yeah.
So it's a continuous game, man. It's a game every day.
What would you say when you talk about this ongoing brutal self-assessment, if I can use those words, what have you found to be like the most practical tools and habits for doing that. I think, man, you can really get lost in the world of organization and productivity and self-improvement and
sure.
feel like there's always some grass that is greener than the grass you're standing on. Like, is this
for
the best
sure.
tool? Should it be Evernote or Notion or, you know, yes. like all of these questions yeah. that you could have. But just as far as like habit, routine and tools are concerned, when it comes to living that self-aware, what Nathaniel Branden called living consciously, right?
Yeah.
What are your best approaches for that, like on a day in, day out basis?
Yeah, I mean, every, you know, for me personally, every day is quite literally mapped out from the time I get up to the time I go to bed. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds obsessive, it sounds OCD, but there's a saying that Jocko Willink has that I've taken to heart. It's actually one of the 11 rules that we have come up with as a family in our house, but it says discipline equals freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, freedom is my favorite F word.
Yep.
Period. Mm-hmm. Everything I do is around that. And so I truly believe for me that mapping out start to finish, I map it out in 20-minute blocks, knowing exactly what I'm going to be doing, when I'm going to be doing it, for me has provided a level of freedom because of that structure. I know what I want to do. I know what I want to get done. It doesn't ever put me in retreat mode and panic mode, and I can stay in the moment, right? I can stay present. And that's one of those things when I'm talking about cultivating peace, people lose sight of peace as soon as it gets outside of their own head, meaning they're living in the past or they're too anxious about the future or they're too worried about what somebody else is doing and or thinking, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Everything I do is to avoid all of those things, all of those four corners. I want to get rid of those and just keep the whole game in here.
Yeah.
The structure of the day absolutely helps with that. And if I do start to feel something emotionally tugging, I will go to my board of directors and I'll figure out, okay, what is it that I'm missing right now? Why am I not at peace? Oh, I'm not at peace because that conversation right there, that kind of irked me for some reason. Why am I giving that particular person the power to actually change my mood? What is it about them or the situation? I try to identify that and go, okay, well then, so what do I need to do to fix that going forward so that I don't care as much, or is there something that needs to be there? There's obviously something that's broken here. What do I need to do to proactively fix that so that doesn't happen in the future? I am consistently having those kinds of conversations in my head, and having the structure of the day laid out allows me to just kind of attack those things one at a time. And it's the best way I can put it.
Block scheduling. You do blocks?
I do 20-minute blocks.
From
about 4:30 a.m. till about 9:30 at night. And I get up at 4:30, and that's Sunday to Sunday, man. And I get up then and I go to bed right about the same time. Obviously things throw stuff off sometimes, but I stay on that schedule.
Yeah. See, so you said at the beginning, that sounds obsessive. It sounds awesome to me. I do block scheduling. I found that to be like in the whole be your own boss. And sometimes, you know, I actually need a boss over my shoulder. It's kind of that, you're familiar with, what's that old book? It's Why Most Small Businesses Fail, the E-Myth. You ever heard of the E-Myth?
Yeah. Okay, I have. Uh-huh.
So we have to wear the manager hat, the entrepreneur hat, and the actual artist or technician hat, right? And if we just want to do something because we love the artistry or the technical work of it, but we're not ready to manage ourselves and we're not ready to have like a longer term vision of what we're doing, we're going to hate the thing. We're going to hate ourselves. We're going to hate we're going to be products of our environment.
That's right.
Yeah, the world is going to close in on us very, very quickly.
That's right. That's a great book. And that's a great concept to understand too. One of the questions that we have on the Essential 11 is like, what is one of the things in your day-to-day, said whoever guest is, that you have to discipline yourself around, things that you need to do that you don't want to do.
Yeah.
But you're doing it because you know it's part of the process. It's part of the means to the end. What is the part of your day-to-day right now that you're like, not super pumped about this, but I need to do it. What does that look like for you? You know, and I love to hear their answers for that, because everybody we have, like you said, there's been some very successful people on that show. They all have something that they're like, okay, currently right now I'm having to do this, but it's because we're doing this. We're launching this product, or we're trying to make this connection, or, you know, whatever that looks like. So,
yeah.
It's cool.
So I was torn on the discipline equals freedom thing for a long time. There's people in my world that I really respect who say, you know, Extreme Ownership, that's Willink's book, right? That was the greatest thing I ever read in my life. Other people I really respect, they're like, I can't get with that guy. You know, he's got this thing that is really just about him, and, you know, he's trying to extend it to other people. So I've heard like both sides of it, but In my assessment of it, I know what a complete lack of discipline looks like and feels like, and how unfree it is when the results come. And, you know, I think a really good way to test this, if people are at the beginning of like their own self-improvement journey, is with some kind of fitness pursuit, right?
Totally.
Like, obviously, the better you take care of yourself, the more freedom you're going to have in your health, but also the more freedom you're going to have in the things you're physically able to do.
Right.
And I think this really hit me last year. Was it just last year? I had a really bad injury, back injury, sciatic nerve, right? SI joint came out and just pressed against it. You know, I realized that even though I had been disciplined, I hadn't been as conscious, right? I realized like all the aspects to discipline that there actually are. Like, you can't tell yourself that you're being disciplined when some aspects of whatever the practice are on complete autopilot. I got hurt doing something stupid at the gym that I shouldn't have been doing, right? Or there was something about myself that I didn't know. It was vulnerabilities that I knew I had that I wasn't paying attention to or wasn't trying to solve. So yeah, if that's an example of lacking discipline, lacking focus, lacking consciousness, the results, the yields as far as lack of freedom are definitely worth avoiding. And if you, you know, don't do any of that stuff at all, the lack of freedom becomes very, very apparent very quickly, I think, in, you know, obesity, lack of health, trips to the doctor's office, dependence on other people for your well-being, like all that stuff really, really, really sucks. So I think it's a pretty easy cause and effect place to start. It's probably easier than like lots of the psychological pursuits or lots of the entrepreneurial pursuits when it comes to yielding results, putting in the work and then seeing results. And then once people see that they can do it there, it's like, all right, well, where else could I do this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's one of those things that moves, you know, from, it doesn't matter what we're talking about at that point, you've had success and then you can start to replicate those patterns of success. What we're really talking about, man, is auditing. You know, when I think of this discipline kind of part, you know, especially with the students that we have here, what we talk about is just auditing your time, you know, and I think that's a big thing that we don't do well just as a species in general. It's not a kid thing. It's an adult thing too. We don't audit our time well and pay attention to how we really spend it. And there are, you know, we live in a time now that's unprecedented and there are so many things vying for our attention. There are so many things that, you know, pick this thing is designed for us to continuously pick it up, to continuously jump on it and go back to it. And next thing you know, you've been on it for 3 hours and you're like, man, where did it go? You know, video games can suck you in with that too. And, you know, there's so many things that can suck you into that. And the next thing you know, you've gone 6 months straight of spending 6-7 hours a day on your phone, 3-4 hours a day on video games. So it doesn't leave you a whole lot of extra time to do other things. And then you're like, ugh, but life sucks. And it's like, well, cool, man, you just wasted 6 months too. Yeah. So it's auditing our time has become, I think, more important than ever. That's part of that discipline.
Yeah. And that scheduling as like a practice is like a real practical thing that you could just do. If you're honest with yourself, and I hear about people saying, you know, I'll lay out my day and it's going to happen exactly like this. I never had a day like that, you know, but I go back and I change it. And that's even if I completely just get lazy at 2 o'clock when I was very ambitious at 6 a.m., it's noted on that thing. And I learned, I think in the audit, you're learning, right? You're learning what your limitations are, what your peak performance times are. And I think that's really important, not just for productivity, but for quality of life. So you can resist that outcome of resenting something, right? Just because you tried to pursue it at the wrong time. So
great point, man. Great point. I know that's exactly it. From doing this for so long and paying attention to that, I know when I'm at my best, you know, what time of day I'm at my best. I down to what kind of food that I need to eat to feel my best. I have all of that down to a flippant T because I pay attention. And you're right. It's that avoiding, you know, being able to avoid being resentful. I have worked every day for probably 5-6 years straight. And when I say I've worked every day, I have done work every day. Now, did I work all day every one of those days? Obviously not.
Right.
But a couple of the days where it's like, okay, I do need to get this done. Here's going to be the time I'm going to do it. It's going to be 2 hours in the morning, you know, whatever. And there are certain days that I know it's like, okay, by this time of day, I really need to shut it off because my mind's not there and I'll start to get cranky around it. And then I'll start to look at the thing, the school or the podcast or the new business or whatever it is. And I'll start to get mad at that when really I'm just not at my personal best right now. I need to just shelf it, hang out with the family right now, come back to it tomorrow. And it's all good. You know, everything's okay. That's self-awareness needs to get to that level for everybody.
Absolutely. So here's what I love about this interview. We're 45 minutes in and we come to topic number two. Matt's background. So you, like I was, were definitely in the schooling matrix, right? You have pretty diverse experience in public schooling and some prestigious higher education institutions as well. So I just wanted to hear a little bit about your background, the highlights, however you want to tell that story. And where I want to get to with that is, what were the events that helped you awaken to the state of things? And then what led to you speaking out about it?
Yeah, really good question. And I'll keep that truncated. Yes. So people can just kind of get the gist. But, my own school experience, right, as this public school kid, I tell people all the time, I got my straight A's all through school. I figured out very early on the game. Mm-hmm. I never got anything but straight A's, but I came out and I was a useless human being.
Yeah.
I had nothing to offer the world. I didn't know myself. I knew how to play school. I was a good athlete. I knew how to talk to girls. Congratulations.
Yeah. Big deal, yeah.
Right. So I was like, I guess I better go to college. And same experience there. I got better at sports, better at girls, got on my straight A's, still came out and went, cool, I'm a useless human being. I know nothing about myself. I know nothing about what I can offer the world. I have no idea where to go. So, through a series of events, series of jobs, I end up at Stanford University, and I'm very thankful for that. Had a great experience there at Stanford, and worked there for a number of years and got to work with all the different departments on campus. And that kind of gave me the bug. I got to speak quite a bit while I was on campus to everybody. And so that kind of gave me the bug to go into education from the standpoint of, I'm learning that I'm really enjoying leading people, speaking to people, kind of leading courses and classes that I was developing. I was trainer of the year. I was all this stuff. I was like, okay, I like this, but I'm also noticing all these kids who are wicked smart. Obviously they're at Stanford.
Yeah.
But at some level too, I'm like, how do you not fall down more? The common sense was just that wasn't there. I saw blind obedience. I was like, man, okay. So you know what? I'm going to go into education and I'm going to change things from the bottom up, right? The naive
inside the system.
I'm going to go in there and shift everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So my wife and I do everything backwards. So we're in the Bay Area, both working at Stanford. We buy a house in Sacramento where it's, obviously less expensive, move there and then have to find jobs. Right. Luckily I got a teaching job, immediately in a public school in a rough area of California. But so as a public school teacher, and as a public school teacher, I was always what I called creatively insubordinate. I was in a gangland area of California. I was absolutely creating great relationships with these kids. I was giving them tools to change their perspective, get happy, try to figure out they're having to go home and being told by mom and dad to sell drugs from the porch, but I'm helping them get out of all this stuff. But what I'm being told by the administrator is no, they need algebra. They need algebra. They need algebra. Yep. And I'm like, no, they need something different. Right. And so that leads to, I'm going to now be an administrator. That's how you actually make things happen, is if you're an administrator, you do it from the site, top down. So I go into administration. You quickly realize that's all about politics. That's about money. It's not about kids at all. When you see how the sausage is made, so to speak. So again, naively, I'm like, okay, well then I'm going to go private, because private, there's none of these rules, none of this, none of these politics. So you can actually make a difference. So go private. You realize a lot of those kids end up having more problems than even the ganglands that I was in before. The private schools are often just trying to copy what the public schools are doing. And so it didn't look any different. There's still politics. There's still money involved. It's still not about the kids. It's the same system that's in place. That's when I really started, just feeling a little more comfortable around speaking out. Went into administration there and was going, man, I want to try some experiments. I'd started diving into John Taylor Gatto and Ivan Illich and, all of these amazing humans that were before us, John Holt, some of these guys. I'm like, let me try some experiments. I'm an administrator here. I'm going to pull some of my administrator strings. I'm going to try an experiment over here with this group of teens. So I take these eighth graders and I basically give them the most open-ended project you can think of and tell them they're going to have nobody to rely on but themselves, right? I took all the adults out of it.
Total gatto. Yep.
Total gatto, right? Took everybody out of there. At the end of 6 months, these students had produced some of the most amazing things you'd ever seen. And I'm talking about, they got a book published and into the hand of every female inmate across the state of California.
Wow.
I'm talking, they had, built a mobile shelter for a homeless person that they could bring their materials with them and also have a shelter. And all of this was completely mobile. All of these amazing ideas, these kids were 13, 14 years old, no adults involved. They got up and they presented these products. They documented the whole thing. They presented this to an auditorium full of people. They had actual investors there who grilled them Shark Tank style, and they stood up. Like, it was one of the most monumental moments for me as an educator. And I had done nothing other than say, look, this is it. I'm going to give you freedom. Right. And so that shifted everything. And they said, most impactful thing we've ever done. Their parents, most impactful thing they ever done. What did the rest of the board, the rest of the administration team go? Okay, that was cool. We're really glad it worked out. But next year, you know, if we're going to do this, we need to be more involved. The teachers, the administrators, we need to be more involved. We need to make sure there's rubrics. We got to figure out how to grade this. We got to, and I'm like, okay, that was the beginning of the end, you know, for me. So I'd been speaking out quite a bit at just very small conferences, which turned into, will you do a breakout around this at the next education conference, which turned into, would you keynote this and talk about some of your ideas? And it really organically kind of took off, where people in education were wanting to hear what I was talking about.
So you prompted a question that made me kind of reflect on some similar experience that I had as a young educator. So I was running this campus of this boarding school when I was 24. So I was just a couple years out of college. I think I was in grad school at the time. Obviously wanting to be a good employee, which is obedience and conformity to a certain extent. But I feel like I had cured myself of apathy. I was in a really, really difficult environment. Lots of inner city kids who also compounded with everything that coming from that environment brings. As you know, a lot of these kids also had what we called at the time, this was 2002 to 2004, sexually reactive behavior issues, right? So they were like very, very closely supervised. They couldn't be by themselves. They had very little independence. It was kind of built into this program that I ran. And I remember like talking to the psychologist is like, are we sending these kids when they get out of here, where are they going? To a mental institution, or are we trying to mainstream them into society? Because if it's the latter, we need to change our approach, because we're setting them up for complete disaster with the lack of independence that they have here. And when you talk, like, yeah, I get the thing about like running into walls with administrators. And once I had kind of learned that, it would be like, you know, I remember like the first few months I was there, can I do this? Can I do that? Can I try this? The second year I taught in that program, a month in, I went to the school's director of education. I said, oh, you know, about a month ago, I started a life skills curriculum, and we're doing a school newspaper, and it's working out really well. And he goes, all right, cool, keep it up. Right? They didn't give a shit. They didn't give a shit what I was doing.
Totally.
You know?
Totally.
But if I told them ahead of time, they would have tried to stop it because it was disruptive and, you know, change and fear and all of those things.
Yep.
But when you talked about having these kids actually be independent, I want to hear what the letting go was like for you, considering the way you were schooled, considering the way you were trained, even though like you figured out way before I ever did that it was a game and it was kind of corrupt. There still had to be some kind of letting go to actually let people that age be independent. Yeah. Because when I did it, I felt like I had to hold hands and I couldn't let go. And then in the end, and I had to like come in on Saturdays and Sundays and stay after school and do a bunch of stuff to then just, you know, I know this sounds like this could come across as insincere, but to convince them that they had done something independently. You know, that was the lesson that I wanted them to walk away from me with, that you can do something, but I could never let go. And maybe it was just like the politics or the environment of the school that I was in, but how did you let go?
Yeah, it was a much longer tail process than that particular experiment that I talked about. Right. You're absolutely right. What you're talking about is breaking people free from their mental, their chains, right? It's this cultural belief. You know, I talk about it all the time in terms of it being a religion, right? We are culturally ingrained around what school looks like so much. I mean, we all grew up in the same kind of schooling process and what that looks like. It has become a religious belief for us. So even if I can intellectually walk somebody through the process of why Acton blows the traditional school environment out of the water, right? And you can walk people through intellectually and they're like, yes, 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 absolutely. Oh my gosh, it's not even close.
Right.
And then you're like, all right, cool. And then their kid's there and they're like, oh my God, right? It's the emotion that won't let them out. It's the religious belief that, you know, this cultural indoctrination of what school looks like. So it was a longer tail process for me too. I was lucky enough to be in the public school and in the private school for a number of years. As I was reading, all of these things from, you know, all those people we mentioned from Gatto. And as I'm reading all of this, I'm there. So I started out very much, even though I was, you know, like most teachers, I was altruistically there to try to make a difference in the kids. No, when I was there, I felt like I needed to control everything. I felt like, yeah, I needed to ask permission. I needed to control the classroom. I needed to control the behavior. I reenacted what school looked like for me growing up. And if the kids were obedient and compliant, those are my good students and great. And I had to focus my attention over here. I was absolutely in that same trap. And the more I started to read, it was a slow transition because I had to emotionally let that go. I had been in, you know, I had been in education for 7, 8, 9 years before I ever got to that point where I was in that experiment. At that point, it was easy for me to let go. I was there, but it took that long for me to get there. And I was fully confident in the, not because I was fully confident in what they would produce and how I was surprised by how amazing everything was, but I was fully confident in the experience, whatever the outcome was going to be so beneficial to them. At that point, I was ready for that, you know, and not every group went to that extreme. Some, you know, had a little bit of their failures longer, but the learning experience itself was great, but it was definitely a long tail thing for me to ever get to that point.
Yeah, I'm really fortunate that I learned it quickly. And I think part of it was just surrender.
Yeah.
I think I was in an environment where I was too young and too green to realize how much power I actually could have had. Like, and I mean authoritative school power.
Right.
I had paraeducators like who were trained in doing physical restraints. I had a behavior manager. I had a timeout room. I had all of these kinds of resources, especially in this environment that was super strict.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, none of this stuff works. None of this stuff is getting any results. And I guess I was fortunate for whatever the circumstances were. I don't even know what outside influences I would have had in life at that time. But I just went, okay, I surrender. None of this stuff works. And it's a lesson that I wish that the public schooling apparatus and the entire like political system could learn. It's like when something doesn't work, you don't go, okay, this doesn't work. How can we do it more and how can we do it harder?
Yeah, let's not double down on
it. We go, I surrender to the reality of this thing not working.
Well, that's, you know, and it's honestly, it's one of the, again, the intellectual versus emotional battle. But intellectually, I can walk people down. You know, one of the big realizations for me was understanding, like, wait a second, the way I'm controlling this classroom and trying to control these behaviors, if somebody was doing it to me, I'd tell them to F off, right? If the rest of my life looked like this, where I was controlled day in, day out, I went to a store and they're like, you can only go down these three aisles. You go down when I tell you, you know, you can only look at these foods. I'd be like, you're crazy. I look at a menu and they're like, no, you can only order right here, this small section. That's it. I'd be like, this is ridiculous, right?
Yeah,
here's the library, but you know what? You can only read these six books. I'd be like, talking about? As I started relating it to the rest of real life and then realizing this is exactly how we treat these young people that are here who are not learning to be people. They are people, right? They're not learning how to be people. They are human beings. Yes, they're younger human beings, but they're human beings. So there's no way they're going to respond well to that. As soon as I started making those connections and those analogies, then what I started to realize was that from a systemic standpoint, quite honestly, the institution that schools most resemble, if you're going to have to try to look at another institution within, you know, humanity that looks similar in terms of operation, it's prison.
Absolutely.
I made that realization and just went, okay, yep, I get it. And I will not be, it was kind of like Gatto's resignation letter, right? Like I'm no longer going to be in this business of harming children. Cause I feel like now if I'm perpetuating this system, I'm actually creating harm and that's not what I'm here for. And I don't think any teach, you know, I won't say 99% of teachers are not there because they want to harm kids. But what stinks is we're in a system that is designed to do just that.
Yeah. What was the title of your TED talk? Like 5 years ago, you gave a TEDx talk and it was something like, it's about to get uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But there's echoes of it. The reason why I brought it up is because it's like, it was the first thing I saw that you did. Joel sent it to me. And I was like, all right, well, that's a place to start. But then I went to your podcast and started listening. And there's still echoes. Some of the things that you said about fear and resistance to change, the fear of going against the majority, that very situation that those people find themselves in, it was present in 2015. And I've heard you mention it a few times in your podcast in 2020, right? So that problem's not going anywhere.
it's not going anywhere. It's one of the biggest enemies to the human condition, man, is fear, you know, I have gotten to the point where I realize it's not a real thing, but that is something that people battle, but you're choosing to battle that. I like what Will Smith said around that, right? The danger is real. Got to pay attention. Danger is real. Fear's a choice.
Yeah.
And we battle that so much as human beings, and we're in a culture that just perpetuates it, obviously.
So I've kept you for an hour. Here's what I'd like to do. I think we've given people in my audience a fine introduction to Matt Baudreau. I would like to ask you back in a month for another hour, and I would like to do a whole conversation starting with like the mission of Acton Academy. You started an Acton Academy in Placer County, California, and talking about it says early on in like the promises that you make to the children who enroll in Acton that they will begin a hero's journey, right? This is something that we've talked about a lot on School Sucks in the past, but I would like to hear like through the Acton lens what that looks like for young people, right? Through the three acts of departure, initiation, and return. What is this hero's journey that young people begin at Acton Academy? So would you come back and do that? And in the meantime, people can, you know, check out your podcast. I'll even in the show notes, I'll even link to a few episodes that I liked.
Yeah, no, I'd be absolutely glad to. I mean, these are all my favorite things to discuss and you know, never turn down interesting conversations with interesting people. So yeah, I'd love to, man.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. This was great.
Pleasure is mine, my friend. Glad we got to do it. Look forward to the next one.